Welcome to Grimshaw Speakers, a partnership between the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound. We bring you conversations with exceptional individuals discussing the issues of our times.
Today we speak with Diana Melrose, the former British ambassador to Cuba and Tanzania, about the lessons she's learned through her career, from activism to diplomacy.
This is a recording from our annual Grimshaw Symposium. Enjoy.
So today, we are incredibly lucky to be joined by Diana Melrose, who has a dizzying amount of experience in international affairs. It would just take too long to list all of it, but we will touch on hopefully as much as possible throughout this event. But given the informal nature of our Grimshaw event, I'm going to let Diana introduce herself and share with us a little bit of how she got to where she is. So please, can we just give a big thanks to
Diana? Oh, no, don't, wait. Suspend judgment, you might not want to applaud.
Okay, all right, well, we will applaud at the end, but please do share.
This is a new one for me, because usually I say Chatham House rules, or I won't tell you the inside stories, but for you guys, I will. So it's absolutely great to be here. I actually came to LSE in September 1973 as part of my Latin American Studies Masters, and the bit of it that I loved most was politics at LSE. I found it really motivating, but the first thing that it taught me was unpredictability of international relations, because does anybody remember what happened in 1973 on the 11th of September? It helps if you grew up in Latin America. Let me tell you, there was a coup in Chile, okay? And my mum, it meant a lot to me, because my mum was born in Chile. I've got a huge family there who was split on left-right lines from the coup, and they still are to this very day. They're fighting it out over the demonstrations in the streets in Santiago today. But taking it back to the politics module, we had a session on militarism. Is it better if I stand up, or should I be sitting down to...
Can everyone at the back...
Yeah, let me stand up.
Okay, go ahead.
We had a session on militarism. And it was Chile is the exception that proves the rule about the role of the military intervening in politics in Latin America. And then on the 11th of September, the poor tutor has to rewrite all his lecture notes because there's the coup. So that, to me, it actually helped me decide on my career, because I was got really caught up in the abuse of human rights, and I thought, I want to work on human rights. And then when I was trying to, I don't know if any of you are in this situation of trying to decide what shall I write my dissertation on, I was struggling to think, and I read a novel by a Peruvian called Alfredo Bryce Echenique's Un Mundo para Julius. It's a book about a boy called Julius who grows up in basically a privileged family, sees poverty around him, and it's his revelation of inequality in society. And it starts with, I lived in a palace in Avenida Salaverry, and that's where we lived when my dad was a British military attaché. And it just hit me, my God. And then all these memories that were buried in me from childhood, and then I thought, I must work on social justice. But it wasn't as easy as is sometimes made out to get into my chosen career. It took me 4.5 years. But I was really happy to work in the city to understand the private sector a bit. And then at Oxfam, I was there during the Thatcher-Reagan era. Well, the 80s and 90s, there were more prime ministers, obviously. But it was a time of... a lot of challenges around the world and in Britain and in the States. And to me, it was my start as an activist. There was so many things that we didn't know what to turn our attention to first. In my case, it was researching lack of access to essential medicines and setting up and being part of an international network to achieve change, which I think is the way you have to do it. Insiders, outsiders working together. Then on I wrote a book about Nicaragua at the and it was aimed at showing the hypocrisy of British foreign policy, because you had Britain doing wonderful things with its aid programs, supporting community development, basic education, healthcare, but at the same time Thatcher was 100% signed up to Reagan, who was funding an illegal war, the Contra, and even mining Nicaragua's harbours in absolute defiance of international law. So, you know, sometimes I think the world isn't static and it's all getting appalling now. It's had its bad points in the past. But all that Oxfam campaigning led to a conservative right-wing government bringing a charity commission investigation against us when we launched a campaign for sanctions against apartheid South Africa. And I remember having to write the defence of how was that delivering our objects of the relief of poverty and suffering. I think you guys could laugh now. We were on the right side of history, but at the time we were in the dock for being political. But we are also very focused on moving beyond aid to the structural causes of injustice. And we actually wrote quite a chunk of the Labour, the government that came in 97's white paper on international development. A lot of it was written in Oxfam with people like Caroline Lucas, who worked for us on climate change, Kevin Watkins contributing. And then I guess my career plays out in politics, because in 1999 I had a phone call. They're advertising a senior job in the Foreign Office, a challenge function. They'd never done it before. But do you remember Robin Cook's, or you'll have read about, sorry, you won't remember, Robin Cook's ethical foreign policy, so-called? Basically, he wanted a challenge function. And I found that amazing. The first paper I wrote was Human Rights Hypocrisy. Why do we beat up on little countries like Cuba that don't matter economically, but China, Saudi Arabia, you can get away with anything. So they were all papers challenging our policy. But then guess what happened? In the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, I was told we're fighting the war against terrorism, we've no time for challenge, this is just after 9/11, your job as head of policy planners ceases to exist. And I was saying, you need challenge now more than you've ever needed it before. Nope, end of that. So I moved to DFID and setting up the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. That's another illustration of multi-sector coalitions for change. I also got to work on international trade. So for the economists amongst you, and those of you following Brexit, I got a taster in WTO conferences of the hard world ahead for the UK if we go ahead and leave the EU. And that's being in the UK delegation when we were the presidency of the EU in Hong Kong. You know, who mattered and who didn't? Wow, wake up. When I hear some ministers being delusional about Britain's influence and its decline, very, very worrying. But then I wanted to be an ambassador. I thought I'd like to go and work overseas. And I said to the Foreign Office, would I be a serious candidate? They were desperate to improve the ratio of women. So they said, yes, but first you have to do a proper job. And I said, because you know, challenging is not a proper job. And I said, so what's a proper job? Well, you could go for one of the EU jobs. So I was head of EU enlargement, and I saw, I had a narrative that would be fill pages and pages of all the benefits of the EU, and spend a lot of time engaging with the countries that wanted to join, particularly Turkey. Then, as an ambassador to Cuba and to Tanzania, I guess I saw the other side of what an academic recently described as Britain's sort of Janus-headed approach to the EU. domestically, there's all this scapegoating the EU for everything that has nothing to do with the EU. Turkey, by the way, was doing the same, Erdogan. Hard economic reforms, blame the EU, very handy. And all that xenophobia and others, you know, it's the fault of others, migrants, whatever. But then there's the other side, the other face, which is what I saw as an ambassador, and that's a very constructive relationship where being membership of the EU has been a wonderful multiplier of everything we've tried to do in terms of values. But I think I should shut up there. My career spans from 73, 74 when we joined the EU, the EEC, right the way to 2016. I resigned after the referendum. I was already quite unhappy with the rather vacuous global Britain stuff. And I thought, I cannot. I've been saying to the Tanzanian government, you should be the powerhouse of East Africa. Open your markets, you know, drop your tariffs. Your future as Africans is to free movement of people. You know, I was praising the EU. And I thought, no, I cannot suddenly represent a Britain in which, was I a citizen of nowhere? I thought, no, I can't represent the UK. I should come back here. So I'm really looking forward to all your questions and our discussion. Would be absolutely great.
I think that, first of all, that's it. Thank you so much. We are so excited to discuss with you. And can I encourage, if anyone was dizzied by the list of incredible experiences that you've had and work you've had, I encourage you to go and look at Diana's LinkedIn to just follow that story, because it's I've really enjoyed diving into kind of all the different roles that you have had. And I should mention that actually Diana wanted to change the title of this event to from activist NGO to ambassador. Sadly, we had already put the promotion information out, so we couldn't do that. But I think that that's a really interesting place to start, because as you said, you began in Oxfam and then moved into government roles, and then ultimately into ambassadorship. What is that transition like? Because there's a lot less freedom to that. You opened the talk by saying that, you know, there used to be a bit of a limit to what you can say in public. How did you find that transition? Was it shocking at all?
To be honest, the Foreign Office that I joined in 1999, I was truly shocked at the time. So I was reading a valedictory telegram from the outgoing British ambassador to Saudi Arabia. And in those days, ambassadors used the final diktel to basically have a go about all the things in their career they hadn't raised. And in it said, the Foreign Office went off the rails when it started admitting women. And I said to my new team, oh, at least this guy's got a sense of humour. And they said, Diana, he means it. And I said, no, you're not serious. So I can remember being a head of department in the Monday morning meeting, which was all men. There were two women there. The deputy undersecretaries were sort of whispering round a table you couldn't hear. Directors sat there, all men. Heads of department, two women, sat here. And I remember thinking, what is the point of this meeting? There's no conclusions. I can't hear what they're saying at the table. The people who know most are not included, and you couldn't just barge in. Yeah. And I thought, the point of this is to celebrate getting to the table. So I thought, this is shocking. But what I did see was I saw change. Like, the first thing, I got involved in setting up assessment and development centres. It was to try and address the fact that there were too many white middle-class men at the top. And we found that it was much harder to get women or black and minority ethnic candidates to apply. But once they did, they had a much higher pass rate, and that's because you had to interact with people, do group exercises. It put a premium on communication skills, interpersonal skills, emotional intelligence. So basically, I saw the Foreign Office change, and the Foreign Office I left was massively changed. I mean, you now have in Africa women in most of the key posts there. You know, our woman Karen at the UN in New York. So it has changed, but it raises a whole lot of issues we could come on to about, do you follow the rules or do you do your own thing? Yeah. And I've spent my life being a boundary basher. I didn't join to be a civil servant and do what I was told. So, for example, in New Labour days, when I was sent to Cuba, I was told your job is to criticise their human rights record. And I'd say, well, okay, you know, that there's things that are very positive in Cuba, there's things that are very negative, like lack of political freedoms. But I rapidly thought, what is the point of just having, you can't lecture a government. I thought, why don't we find areas where we actually have a common agenda? And what I spotted was climate change. So I invited the UK climate change special representative, at the time it was John Ashton, to come. And he was absolutely knocked out. He said the Cubans have a science-led approach to climate change. Wow. And he went to a presentation where the effects of climate change or the risks to Cuba were explained. And he said, I can't think of a single institution in Britain where I could get a holistic analysis of the threats facing the UK. And just to complete that story, the UK and Cuba then became close allies in the climate negotiations, always working behind the scenes. Both very good at drafting, the UK as the Cubans are, and Cuba had problems with some of its ideological allies like Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia were taking quite an ideological US bashing but not very pro-climate approach, and our job was to try and beat up the Americans. Well, but so I firmly believe that you can be an activist. And I would have left if I couldn't have been, frankly.
Excellent. That's really interesting, because a lot of the time you hear about kind of the restrictions and one assumes there is a huge amount of restriction to a role like that where you are within government. I've got two quick questions on that. How much pushback did you get to your kind of rebellion and to your pushing? How would you advise someone who is going to take that risk within whatever job it might be? It might be government departments or any part of, like, you know, leading kind of a bit of activism in work. How do you weigh up the potential risks and benefits? How do you deal with pushback? A little advice for students? What do you think?
Well, I did notice that people who were younger than me and were at the start of their career were very concerned not to offend the people at the top in case it affected their career. And I think that can become very dangerous, because then the politicians are getting a sort of reinforcing of their misguided ideas. But let me give you an example of something that you might find surprising. So back when I was head of policy planners at the Foreign Office, that's kind of like a think tank. So you write papers challenging foreign policy. I wrote one on the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Are our long-term interests best served? And it said predictable things about our Middle East policy is sort of off the rails. We're not being strategic in terms of foreign policy. This is before the invasion of Iraq. But then I met a young British, my opposite number, who was head of the policy think tank at the Department for Education and Science, whatever it was called then, DFES, was a young British Muslim. And I said, look, would you do me a favour? It's just after 9/11. Would you do some research, just, you know, unofficial research in your community into how that's affected people's thinking?
This is in the UK?
In the UK, okay. Sorry, entirely in the UK, in Birmingham. And she came back saying, Diana, it's extraordinary. People who once defined themselves as, I'm a Brummie, i.e. I'm from Birmingham, I'm British Asian, I'm British Pakistani or Bangladeshi origin, I'm this, I'm that, I'm a Muslim. After 9/11, I'm a Muslim was the first thing of our multiple identities. That's what people said first. And she then said to me, I can see some real problems here of people feeling alienated by British foreign policy, but other people, maybe mainly in the Bangladeshi and Pakistani community, feeling they're losing out in terms of educational opportunities, they're not getting the job opportunities they aspire to, there's alienated people. So I went to Scotland Yard and there was a meeting with the leaders of the Muslim community, and I heard a dialogue of death with the police. They were saying to the Metropolitan Police, you're not hearing us. We do not represent young British Muslims. They see us all as sellouts. There's anger, there's radicalism. So I basically took all this young woman's ideas, and that's, you can just sort of appropriate it all, no intellectual property, and I wrote my paper with her recommendations of what we should do, and I ended it saying, if we do not deal with Muslim grievance in the United Kingdom, then this is, I'm writing this in 2001, the next terrorists will come from Birmingham, Leeds, or Leicester. Now, the permanent undersecretary, my boss, said, he's a very clever man, by the way, I respect him. Very clever stuff, Diana, all very interesting. This has got nothing to do with foreign policy. And I thought, how can you keep domestic in one box, foreign in another? The world isn't like that. So, maybe I should have shouted louder. But they did say to us the strategy we'd advocated, which was to have a more integrated plan for young British Muslims, would fall foul of Britain's race relations, and that you can't favour one group over another, like British Sikhs might say this isn't on.
I see.
But I think it's blinkered thinking.
So another question I have, this is particularly interesting to me because it came up in a conversation recently with someone who had spent a long time working for DFID, but recently had just had enough and couldn't do it. And this was inspired by the current government and feelings about that. So I always find this very curious. It came up when Trump was elected. There were a lot of civil servants who just could not kind of justify it. There was criticism, but also, you know, discussion about how we should continue and, you know, keep the fight and so on. You have obviously experienced how many changes of government during your time in government roles. You entered in 2000.
Yeah, I added them up somewhere.
Did you?
I entered government in 99.
So you had New Labour.
Yes, I had New Labour. I had. And I actually preferred the Conservatives' policy on Cuba. It was more pragmatic and allowed me to
post 2015. Yeah.
That was in 2010. They 2010, won the
right,
elections.
Right, of course. So New Labour coalition, and then 2017.
I got out in 2016.
I'm forgetting 2015. Anyway, what I'd love to ask is, how did you experience the changes of the guard? Were there any particular changes which struck you as being quite real changes in policy? What's the dynamic internally dealing with changes of government? I think that's fascinating and challenges you might have experienced in that.
Not just DFID, but wider.
No, any of your many roles within government and FCO and so on.
Right, so at the moment there's a whole lot of young civil servants who are writing scenarios. So basically in Britain, when the election happens, the new government is in power from the next morning or the minute somebody is, you know, has gone to Buckingham Palace. So basically as a civil servant, you have to get ready a brief for a Boris majority government. You have to do one for a Boris minority government. You have to do one for a Labour majority. You know, you have to do one for every scenario, and they'll do one for a Lib Dem, you know, an agreement with SNP. And for every major policy area, you have to write, this is how to deliver your the policy you want. So I've done that in different roles in government, and they do it very thoroughly. Because I don't know, is there another country in the world that has a transition of power overnight? I mean,
Australia, we also run a blue book and a red book. So for a Labor government, we don't have the middle Lib Dems, but we do the same thing, writing one thing and then the other, and then destroy one of them the next morning.
Okay, that's really interesting. Yeah. So, but that means that you have to be on your toes and ready. So, for example, in Cuba, I was thrilled in terms of Cuba policy to have a conservative government. Why? Because Labour had been in to just lecture Cuba on human rights. Not even a desk officer was allowed to visit unless they saw the opposition, which meant that they wouldn't get to see the government. And I'd say this is ridiculous. We talk to the so-called opposition all the time. Two-thirds of them are infiltrated by the security services. You know, there is not a real change will come from within the Communist Party. So please send out people from all levels. And Labour said no. But William Hague came to see me in opposition, and I was quite amazed because he said, I'm seeing Hillary Clinton next week, what should I tell her? So I said, you know, American policy, absolutely atrocious, they've kept this government in power, Cubans are suffering, this is what's wrong with it. And at the end, William Hague said, yeah, tell me something I don't already know. And I thought, right. And he then published in the Times Online an article attacking US foreign policy towards Cuba, which I thought was amazing from a conservative future foreign secretary. And it meant that we could do the shift to climate change. Where have we seen that? Then you also get changes, frankly, every time you get a different Secretary of State.
Right.
So when I was in Tanzania, the DFID seemed to have a new Secretary of State every other year.
Remind us what time period.
Okay, it was. So we're 2013 to 2016. We had Justine Greening, who arrived quite unhappy that she'd lost the transport job, you know, like, oh, I've got international development. I saw her leave passionate, I've got the best job, and she wanted to make the focus very much economic opportunities, economic empowerment, a lot of focus on gender equality. And each Secretary of State seemed to want to push it slightly in a different direction. But I guess one of the main differences, I've been very, there's a fantastic Lord's report from last year about British foreign policy, which I found really interesting. And the permanent undersecretaries of the Foreign Office that I most respect, Peter Ricketts is one, there are others, they're intensely criticized of British foreign policy over the last few years, saying it's not proactive, it's not agenda setting, it's not risk taking, it's just all over the place. We've sort of removed ourselves. I don't know, does that answer your question?
I think so.
There was more focus on, I know a big change that happened. So at one stage, development aid was, we're here to deliver the SDGs, we're here to end, you know, to really focus on the poorest, most marginalised and deprived, work with the governments in a range of ways. And then more and more of the aid budget was being nicked into the Foreign Office and into MOD. And it was being the Prosperity Fund, for example, was really UK export promotion with a veneer of pretending it was about poverty. It was about no such thing. And Britain, I remember Britain in the days in the OECD representing the UK, where we were defining, you know, the rules for aid. It's about poverty focus. And suddenly I find that we're breaking all the rules.
Interest-based.
and also not spending money anything like as well as DFID with the professionals.
So yes, I mean, evidently there have been such significant changes during your career. In a moment, I'm going to open up to discussion because I think I'm sure you guys have so many questions. So do have a little think about questions you'd like to ask. I've got a whole bank over here, so don't worry if you're lacking. I'm prepared. Also, in the time that you've been in FCO work, trade work as well, all of these discussions and dynamics, the players have changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether that be China increasingly at the table, and I'm sure, you know, you're in contact with your fellow ambassadors for different countries and so on. Could you tell us a little bit about kind of start to finish with the FCO, if you could bookend the players that were there and the players that were then there when you were leaving and when you left in 2016, and what that dynamic, you know, meant to you, how it changed your work, that would be really enlightening.
Okay, so I guess when I joined the Foreign Office, the planners have these supposedly secret talks, the quads. It's basically the US, the UK, France and Germany meet regularly. But when it got interesting, we started expanding it. And I remember going to Moscow, would have been in about 2000, 2001, and I sat down with the director of policy planning, a man called Alexei Meshkov, who was much more senior in the system than I was in the British one. But I remember saying to him, Alexei, which do you think that Russia will join first? A rebranded NATO or the European Union? And he said definitely the rebranded NATO. Now I kind of think, what did we get wrong? That there was a time when we could have that kind of conversation about cooperation and, you know, common joint security. I can see how tarnished the West is by the sort of push, aggressive push, as the Russians see it, to expand NATO. And also we were perceived as being too caught up in Yeltsin, democracy equals corruption at the time. There was a lot of things that went wrong. But I'm kind of very conscious of lost moments,
like
when
that.
We were between the Cold War divisions. Then there was a moment when things could have been different. And now Russia's sort of firmly in the camp of cyber enemy. What are we going to do to protect ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
Biggest change has to be the pivot to Asia that started with Obama, and I think Britain has kind of been maybe slower about. But when I was at the WTO in Cancun and then in Hong Kong, China wasn't a member. But all the same, the only countries that mattered were the US, or I should say members, the US, the EU, and the G20. That's the big developed countries. Japan hardly got a look in some of the negotiations. And I say this from the basis of having kind of spoken to Peter Mandelson, who was the EU trade rep, quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I used to meet him at the swimming pool. We were the only two who'd go swimming, and he'd kind of compare notes on the day. But it's just weird.
While going up and down the lanes.
There was no China there. So then, just in my last year in policy planners, it was actually the beginning of 2003, Blair suggested, sorry, it must have been Gordon Brown then, was it?
Yeah.
To get me right on my
what
dates.
What
were you? 2003. Who was?
Oh no, I think still Blair.
Still Blair.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, Blair. So he suggested that Chinese planners should come to the UK. And we had this extraordinary meeting in Lancaster House, where, if you can imagine it, like, you guys are the Chinese negotiators and we have a longer table and we're the UK, and there's the Chinese guy and me in the middle, and we're the only two that talk. It's really weird. But what was the agenda about? I was absolutely fascinated what they chose to talk about. One section was about international development with a particular focus on Africa, like they really wanted to hear our views on, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, mm-hmm. which I later saw with, you know, the whole belt and road, yeah. And so then you scroll forward to being ambassador in Tanzania. I actually got to shake Xi Jinping's hand, basically because I'm very cheeky. There was a photo opportunity happening with all the former presidents, and I thought, this is really boring, I'd like to go meet him. So I just charged in and said, you know, Your Excellency, it's an honour to meet you. It was his first trip abroad. He went first to Moscow to minus 30 degrees, then to Tanzania, plus 30 degrees. And it's because China had special links to Tanzania from the days of socialism, Nyerere, and they kept very close links. And so you basically, when I arrived, the UK was way the biggest investor in Tanzania. By the time I was leaving, you know, China was coming up every year by the minute. And now I see what, in 2050, maybe in my lifetime, China and India will be bigger GDP than the whole of the current G7. Like, the world is changing, and I'm not sure that British foreign policy has caught up. We had signed an agreement in Beijing and in London to partner in Africa and international development and investment. I had a couple of sessions with my Chinese opposite number. He invited me round to teach me calligraphy and how to cook lovely Chinese meals, but he seemed a lot less interested in seriously talking about, like, how are we going to partner in business. Mm-hmm. This was, China knew just what it wanted, mm-hmm. and it didn't really feature us lot. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's too long-winded. No, but
that's
it's
perfect. That's wonderful. Now, I'd like to open it up, because I have been talking too much, and I'm sure you guys have some questions. So just pop up your hands, and we'll get cracking. Anybody got any questions?
Thanks for your presentation. I'm interested in your views on kind of the lack of risk-taking within British foreign policy over the years, and kind of the role that's played in kind of the UK lagging in its foreign policy and its competitiveness. Thinking about the UK and Latin America in particular. So I actually spent a year in the Foreign Office covering Latin America. And one of the things that really struck me was you have the usual candidates such as the Canada, the US, France and Spain active in Latin America. Then you also have quite unusual candidates, China obviously, but also the likes of Germany. So, and I was kind of wondering, why is the UK not in that space as much? So just your views on kind of the lack of risk taking, whether that
Yeah, how interesting. When were you in FCO? Was that
2017 to 2018?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I have a feeling that, and if you look at where DFID has almost no program in Latin America, I kind of feel that Britain is more an absence in Latin America, with a few exceptions. I mean, obviously, there's some key markets where they are, Brazil, Mexico, but they have alliances with some countries more than others, Colombia obviously, and Chile. But I think that the gravitational pull has been more Europe, North America, the Commonwealth, the rest of Asia, Africa. And I see a sort of withdrawing from Latin America, which is a great shame, really. Even though, if you look at what the Foreign Office is saying, we've got, 160 ambassadors in 193 UN member states, and the plan now is to have even more in every country. Because my dad was a diplomat in Peru and then in Argentina in the 60s and 70s, and he grew up in Colombia, Argentina, Uruguay, so that was like, you know, where it felt that the relationship for all the problems was much closer. So I'm intrigued by what you say about risk-taking, because Is it risk, or is it that we've just sort of absented, we should be being more present and doing more? I think where there's an exception is maybe Colombia. I go to a lot of conferences in Oxford where I live, and I love being around young students like you because the debates are much more interesting. There was one at the Blavatnik not long ago when Juan Manuel Santos, the former president of Colombia, came to speak. And I asked him a question because I'd always wanted to know about Cuba's role in facilitating the peace process in Colombia, which he confirmed was very significant. But before I spoke, they let some stuffy old academic, speak first. And he just laid into the Foreign Office about everything to do with Latin America. And I thought, no, that's not right. And it was really interesting. Juan Manuel Santos said the British played an absolutely critical role in helping us end the conflict in Colombia. And he cited human rights training for the military so that they began to build the trust of the people, which they absolutely didn't have before. He was much more positive. So I think there's been some exceptions, places like Colombia where they got pretty involved, but there's too much withdrawal. Do you agree? But I don't know where risk comes in, because they wouldn't... They got very focused on, like, the war against terrorism, Latin America doesn't feature. It's like, don't worry about it too much.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it, from the perspective of Latin America is the least prioritised region, I think, in British foreign policy. Mm. But at the same time, you have Brazil in the Prosperity Fund. No kind of, as I say, different presence. Well, they close their Caribbean programmes. And then you have kind of in leadership meetings, people saying, yeah, you know, there's real opportunities in Latin America, but they're not acted upon. So whether that's resource funding, scarcity, sort of, well, yeah.
Yeah, we should do more, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any other questions?
I worked for an NGO in Nepal for 2 years. It was a different and ILO funded project. And after those 2 years, I said to myself, I'm never working for an NGO again because of the kind of bureaucracy that came into play and the amount of interest that would go into, you know, like a small project that I was working for. And the little that actually reached the ground and the impact that I saw was nothing. Like, I was, at the end of 2 years, I was like, they're only working to save their jobs. It's not like, I felt like there was no impact in me on the ground. Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel that sort of bureaucracy come into play while you were working for an NGO or did it?
That's really worrying. Have you spoken to DFID, by the way? Have you given them your... Because you should do. They'd be very open to hearing your feedback. I'd encourage you to. Do you know, I think... Well, I'm now a trustee of Save the Children UK, and we saw, like, the biggest challenge facing NGOs is achieving impact and demonstrating that you are. So the thing I enjoy most there is being a member of the Impact for Children Working Group, where we're challenging ourselves on what are we actually achieving. But sometimes I used to get worried with DFID was, you know, all those log frames? You must have seen the log frames, yeah. And the actual impact in the lives of poor people seems very remote. I'm going to give you an example of something that the head of DFID Tanzania in my day did, which I thought was brilliant. He's a guy called Val Ganandran, who I think is really fantastic, who's actually left DFID, sadly. But he set up a youth advisory group, and the idea was DFID will never fund a new program in Tanzania without consulting a group of young, articulate Tanzanians. And I listened in on their meetings. They absolutely took programs apart. And the challenge was just fantastic around how you should reorient it. So I think feed in any ideas you have about how it could have been done better.
I want to get your take on the Commonwealth. So I'm a couple of major country in Commonwealth. And every time I see FCO foreign and Commonwealth office. I always feel that Commonwealth is not something that the UK actually cares about. it seems like it's always an afterthought. So what, in your experience when you went to FCO, what was the relevance, or what was there any emphasis on the Commonwealth when you were especially in the planning unit?
There was emphasis on the Commonwealth, and I predict you will hear more and more and more and more. If Brexit goes ahead, the Commonwealth is going to be trotted out again and again and again, looking for those alliances. It was quite real in my job in Tanzania. We worked together as Commonwealth ambassadors, so when there were elections, the Commonwealth sent an election observation mission, which was great. It was actually headed by Goodluck Jonathan, who'd just given up power having lost an election in Nigeria, so that was a good example. And he did take it quite seriously, so we met and briefed him, this is how you can expect the ruling party to try and steal the election, which they did in Zanzibar for about the fifth time. And so you could see things being organised and done. In my days back in DFID, I can remember going to a breakfast that Tony Blair hosted for Commonwealth heads of government from the Caribbean. They get one every year if CHOGM, you know, the Commonwealth CMAG, the Commonwealth Ministerial Action Group, and then CHOGM heads of government is happening in London. And on that occasion, the trade person had dropped out, so I was told to come. And I had no idea what the brief was. And Tony Blair at the time was completely focused on a domestic problem, foundation hospitals. He had a vote in the Commons, and he ate his eggs and bacon and left me to deal with the righteous anger of the Commonwealth heads of government of the Caribbean. And they were attacking us for pushing sugar regime reform in the EU, which we were. And I was saying, but you can't compete with Malawi. They produce sugar 40 times less than you. You can't compete with Brazil. You have to diversify your economy. And they were saying, into what? So I could see they had the forum to meet the Prime Minister, but I didn't see him as engaged as he should have been. And I did get a bit involved in the selection of the Commonwealth Secretary General. We were pushing very hard to have somebody who'd really push a rights agenda. But I think my conclusion was that Commonwealth governments have such diverse interests that it's quite hard to get people to agree on anything as a group. I'd be really interested in your views as other Commonwealth citizens.
I'm checking my 2 cents. Thank you very much for your presentation. It was really, really interesting. My name's Maris, and I work for the Australian Foreign Office. And I used to work for AusAid when it was a thing, and then we were integrated into yeah. The Foreign Office. But yeah, since 2016, from Australia, I think we've definitely seen an increase in Commonwealth outreach and activities from the UK. I mean, before that, it was not really a thing, but then every year from 2016 onwards, there was a Commonwealth Day reception at the High Commissioner's place, and so I think that sort of thing. But we more in the soft power sense. I mean, particularly with Australia, as a developed country, not any recipient country, it's purely in the soft power sense. But as you said, I worked a little bit on some CHOGM and things, and it's hard to find a common agenda. Climate change was one agenda for a bit, but then Australia's changed its tact
But I guess there's some informal, for example, Australia and New Zealand tend not to have as many embassies. So we always had a thing where we would look after, I was responsible for Australian and New Zealand citizens, all Canada was, we take it in turns. So there was kind of informal sharing and support.
Thank you very much, Diana, for the presentation. I'm currently studying human rights here at LSE, and I'm just curious, given your background in human rights activism, what were some of the skills and insights that you gained that helped you work on issues things like trade or climate change later on in your career? Because for me personally, I feel like, given my academic background, I'm not sure what kind of skills I would need in order to work on those broader international initiatives like trade later on. So I'm just curious what you learned about.
So you said you were doing human rights?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. Yeah, so I guess, I mean, I started off doing languages, which had nothing to do with any of it. I kind of thought that we're at some level we're in danger of becoming too specialized and not being able to move between different disciplines. So, like, I mean, I would have loved to have your expertise on human rights in order to take on people who were kind of denying their, I wrote the rights approach to development for Oxfam, the mm-hmm. sort of framing our objectives, and remember having huge fights with barristers who took a very reductionist view of rights. They saw them as civil and political, said those are the only justiciable ones, you know, social and economic don't exist, and I would have loved to be able to argue. But I think through my career, what I've discovered is you need to reach out in networks to find the right people and tap their expertise. We can never be experts in everything. I was describing, well, beginning to talk earlier about my first day as head of international trade at DFID. I was quite intimidated by the fact there were 30 economists in my department all doing these econometrics. I didn't know what econometrics were. So I went on a two-day course, Economics for Non-Economists, and I learned enough for my purposes. So I said, now it's very interesting what you're doing, these econometric sophisticated stuff, and I can see you're looking at minor tariff variations and how they would affect developing countries' ability to export. However, aren't you missing two key variables? One, political will. Two, do they actually have anything to export? What about supply side capacity? So coming in fresh, I got rid of some of the economists and brought in some people with broader social skills, you know, a range of disciplines, and we developed something called Aid for Trade, which was where the UK was putting money into building supply side capacity. And then the EU took it up as well. There's the multiplier. We have a good idea, you sell it to the EU, and then, you know, it's much, much broader. So I think it's a willingness to listen, to learn, to experiment. I think that's what's important. And never to stop sort of opportunistically grabbing people. Am I allowed to tell a story of
how... Please do.
Okay. So when I was ambassador in Tanzania, I once went shopping at the weekend. I needed to go to a loo, so I popped into a 4-star hotel. And on the way out, I saw all these television cameras, and I thought, wow, what's going on? And I went up, and there was a young, very attractive woman speaking to camera, and I went to listen, and she was addressing Tanzanian girls in English, which surprised me, because, you know, Kiswahili is what people would normally be speaking. And she was saying, girls, don't limit yourselves, be ambitious for yourselves, don't let them marry you off early, become who you want to be. And I went up and said, wow, you're really inspiring, who are you? And she said, I'm DJ Cuppy from Nigeria, who are you? And I said, I'm Diana, the British High Commissioner. So we swapped cards and we emailed about our experience of being women and kind of challenges we'd faced in our careers. And then I discovered from listening to an interview that her daddy, well, somebody said, it's all very well for you saying don't limit yourself, your daddy's a billionaire. And she said, no way will I let you get away with that. I have had challenges. They're different to other women's, but don't tell me I haven't. We all face challenges. So years later, I'm a trustee of Save the Children, and we're launching an Africa philanthropy initiative. I'm asked, can I think of anyone we should get on our advisory panel? I contact Cuppy, she comes to Save the Children. She was a fellow alumni of mine at King's, by the way, alumna there. And to cut a long story short, she hosted a gold fundraising gala in Abuja, the first ever of its kind. and that raised, from one person, her father, raised close on £11 million. The richest man in Africa, Dangote, was sitting next to him, gave some more. And basically, in the media, it was all, we've neglected children in the northeast of Nigeria, the war zone, that's who's going to benefit. You know, government, more of us, we need to look at the challenges of this war-torn zone. And she said on stage, this wouldn't have happened if I hadn't have met Diana in Tanzania. And I was thinking, it's not expertise, it's kind of those casual people you meet and having the courage to pursue them. And I think that's how you get jobs as well. Mm-hmm. You talk to people, you extend your network, and then you'll get to hear about things.
Excellent. And you'd say that on, I was actually, that was honestly a question that I was going to ask Diana, if there's kind of a skill that you have and feel has kind of taken you to success in all of your different roles. Would you say it's that, having that courage to go and say hello and kind of maintain that connection and keep learning and constantly go for it? Would you say that's the one that we should take on?
I definitely think reaching out to people.
Mm-hmm.
I've learned something from everybody I've ever met, I think. Some of it is negative learning, but I definitely think that.
Excellent.
And having the confidence to do that, absolutely.
Totally brilliant. We are sadly out of time, which is totally tragic. I actually might quickly ask, is there someone after us? Do we need to vacate?
I think we have room until 3, actually. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, obviously, I understand if people need to pop off because the event was supposed to be until 2. But if you have more questions, does anyone have any further questions they'd like to ask? Diana?
And can I say something while
yes.
you're just thinking? At the front, I'm also a trustee of ODI, the Overseas Development Institute, which is the think tank. We're very embarrassed by the name because it's very caught in a sort of colonial time warp, isn't it, Overseas Development? And we like to call it the Global Issues Institute, but we can't afford the rebranding. But I basically cleared my shelves, and I'm not going to take these back to Oxford. So if there's anything here that interests you, just grab it. They work on loads of issues and have really interesting content online. So political themes, international development, and they have events in Southwark, you know, just across the river. We should get speakers from there.
We're going to try and reach out and maybe have some events with ODI. But let's give a huge round of applause to Diana, because you just did excellent.
Many thanks to our speaker, Diana Melrose. The wonderful music was by Ashley Lyle Marsing. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. For more info on the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound, check out our websites.